Every year, thousands of migrants cross the U.S.-Mexico border searching for a better life. But not everyone crosses safely. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio. This is Fronteras, a public radio show about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. Some migrants who cross the border illegally on their journey into the U.S. go missing. KPBS Fronteras reporter Jean Guerrero brings us the story of a farm worker who dedicates his free time to searching for those missing migrants.
Eli Ortiz is searching for signs of the dead. He's in a stretch of the Arizona desert along the U.S.-Mexico border where there isn't any fencing, just a barrier created by nature. Here, it's the extreme temperatures that stop people from coming through, killing hundreds each year.
Drink water. Don't wait until you're thirsty. Drink. Drink, boys.
The North San Diego County farm worker is flanked by about 20 volunteers. Suddenly, they stop. A hot desert breeze is carrying a smell they've learned to identify as decomposing human flesh. Despite Ortiz's frequent encounters with death, his senses never dull to it. Sweat drips from his face. He looks left and right.
La mera verdad, yo siento miedo. Miedo al irrespeto a la vez al desierto porque.
I have fear and respect for the desert. It can devour you in just a few hours.
Ortiz created Águilas del Desierto, or Eagles of the Desert, to find missing migrants, dead or alive.
Cuando recibo una llamada de una madre.
When I receive a call from a mother crying, begging me for help, saying her son or her husband is lost, my soul breaks. And I say, I have to do this, because if I don't, who's going to do it?
Ortiz and his team are made up of farm workers, plumbers, construction workers, mostly immigrants based in San Diego. They drive hours to get to remote places like this. Ortiz started the group after finding the body of his own brother, Rigoberto, in the Arizona desert. Rigoberto died trying to cross the border illegally in 2009.
Se me acabaron ilusiones, se me acabaron.
I lost all illusions, all ambition for having things. I stopped having desires to be somebody. I wanted to dedicate my life to helping people who suffer this.
Ortiz blames U.S. border fence construction for the death of his brother and thousands of other people. In the late 1990s, under the Clinton administration, the U.S. government implemented Operation Gatekeeper. Dozens of miles of steel gates around San Diego rerouted migrant traffic into remote desert areas like this one.
The United States, with its policies, how many deaths has it cost?
Like the fencing that went up in the 90s, Trump's wall could push migrants into increasingly dangerous areas, something Ortiz says is inhumane.
The wall is a method of discrimination. It's a way of saying, you're inferior to me, and here I am, marking my territory.
Often, nature leads Ortiz straight to the missing. Vultures hover above as someone dies. The wind carries the smell of the dead. If coyotes have torn a body apart, Ortiz finds skeletal remains near large stains of grease left behind as a body melts on the desert floor. This time, it's the wind that leads the águilas to the stain, but the volunteers don't find any bones. Ortiz thinks the medical examiner, alerted by Border Patrol, must have picked up the body. But it appears officials left behind crucial clues about the person's identity.
Did you guys see these IDs?
They find an ID from El Salvador. It belongs to someone named Jose Francisco Vividor. And near the ID, a stack of letters. Ortiz reads part of one aloud.
I love you so much, Francisco, my love.
The letters appear to be from the man's girlfriend or wife. Ortiz shakes his head. He folds up the letters, which he'll later use to help officials connect a body to a man, and ultimately, a man to his grieving family. For Fronteras, I'm Jean Guerrero.
Since the late 1970s, Guatemalans have been crossing the border into the United States in large numbers, taking their indigenous languages with them. As Guatemalan immigration continues under a climate of anti-immigrant rhetoric and policies, demand for translators of America's ancient languages is on the rise. Marfa Public Radio's Elizabeth Trovall explains.
Carmelina Cadena wanted to be an interpreter since she was a child. At 5 years old, she left her home country of Guatemala. Her family was fleeing extreme violence.
My uncles, my cousins were put in a house and they were set on fire while they were still alive.
After a couple years in Mexico, Cadena and her family crossed into U.S. territory, where they were met by Border Patrol.
We turned ourselves in to immigration and we were just there at their mercy.
Her family, unlike many Guatemalans at the time, were able to understand some Spanish, but they mostly spoke the Mayan language Acateco. Cadena watched her mom struggle to understand court documents and proceedings as the immigration status of her family hung in the balance.
We had to wait all these years that we were just pending and pending and pending and pending and pending.
Cadena eventually did get her residency and citizenship, though it took decades. Her experience inspired her to found Maya Interpreters, an organization that hires speakers of 14 Mayan languages to do telephonic interpretations all over the U.S., including West Texas. Business has been good, too good. She's struggling to meet demand for interpreters, which are hired by organizations like refugee resettlement programs and immigration courts.
As soon as January hit, we noticed there was a spike.
Cadena says she attributes increased demand on the election of President Trump.
I truly see it as I think we need to all get in before the wall goes up.
Guatemalans have been immigrating to the U.S. for decades. When civil war violence spiked in Guatemala during the late 1970s, people fled their country in droves. And it's still an issue today. Guatemalan immigration is up 31% from 2007. In terms of illegal immigration, more than half of people apprehended crossing the southwest border last year were from Central America, some 220,000.
We've seen a steady increase in what we term as other than Mexicans, majority of those being Guatemalans.
Rush Carter is a supervisor at the Big Bend sector of the Border Patrol. The sector makes up a quarter of the southwest border. Parked on the side of Highway 90 near Alpine, Carter points to a hill where agents are tracking a group they suspect are Guatemalans. Carter says they're hard to track. To avoid leaving footprints, they wear carpet on their shoes and usually are being guided by professional smugglers or coyotes. When the Border Patrol does find a group, communication is crucial.
With the Guatemalans, we do hear more of that indigenous language, is what you would call it. Of course, our agents are all trained in Spanish. However, when they hear something like that, it's a foreign language to them.
Though many Guatemalans do speak Spanish, organizations like the Border Patrol and immigration courts sometimes have to call on translation services like Cadena's for help. Last year, two of the top 10 languages used in immigration courts nationwide were Mayan. High demand for interpreters and the fact that some Mayan languages are incredibly rare creates challenges for immigrants. Benito Juarez works for New American and Refugee Affairs for the city of Houston.
You know, if you don't have language services available for somebody that is going through the immigration system, it makes more difficult the process and even can affect the outcome.
He says there are just three organizations nationwide that provide translation assistance for indigenous Guatemalans going through the immigration process. One is Maya Interpreters, Cadena's company. She says although she'll be scrambling to facilitate translations, it's worth it. She sees it as her American duty.
That was Marfa Public Radio's Elizabeth Troval reporting. Coming up next on Fronteras, DACA recipients report high levels of psychological stresses because they might be facing deportation.
Depression will limit them in their ability to respond, whereas anxiety is keeping them in their hypervigilant state that allows them to continue to fight.
We'll explore that story when we come back. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio. Welcome back to Fronteras.
President Trump drastically dropped the cap for refugee admissions in fiscal year 2018 to 45,000. That's having a big impact in Texas. Since October 1st, only 400 refugees have been resettled here, compared to the 4,700 refugees who moved to Texas during the last fiscal year. Aaron Rippenkroger, CEO of Refugee Services of Texas, says clients are wondering whether their family members will be able to join them in the U.S. Right now, those answers aren't clear.
The state of confusion over what's happening with their case being activated and deactivated and then back and forth.
Rippenkroger says despite the drop in the number of refugees being resettled in Texas, his organization has received more donations and requests to volunteer in the last year than ever before in its history. In September 2017, President Trump announced that protections under DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, would end for thousands of undocumented immigrants brought into the U.S. illegally with their parents. Trump gave Congress 6 months to extend those protections for these so-called dreamers, but no solution appears to be on the horizon. How is this heightened threat of deportation affecting the mental health of dreamers? That's what Luz Garcini of Rice University is researching. A postdoctoral fellow at Rice's Department of Psychology, Garcini has been studying the psychological stresses on the undocumented community. She's created an anonymous online survey for dreamers and their families to measure their levels of stress.
And one of the findings in this series of studies that I've been doing was that those most at risk were undocumented immigrants in the age range of 18 to 25. Now, given I did not assess anyone who was younger than 18. But if you start thinking about that age group, it's most likely representative of the dreamers. And a lot of DACA recipients were in that group. And that led me to start thinking about what made them different when I started comparing them to other their undocumented counterparts. And I think their stressors were very unique to this group. You know, this is a group that is highly acculturated, that were often brought to the United States by their parents, that literally they almost perceive themselves as being U.S. born. You know, they dominate English. The majority is educated, or at least has a high school education, which contrasts considerably with other age groups of undocumented immigrants. And they're usually the culture brokers for their family members. Now, my data was collected prior to the present administration. My data was collected in 2014, bridging into 2015. So as I started doing interviews with the media, one question of the reporter was, well, how can we start noticing what the current actions and the current comments and the current laws, what effect are they having on the health of DACA recipients? You know, we don't know if some of these actions are preventing them from even seeking mental health services, from going out to work, even from spending and stimulating the economy, right? So we don't know what's actually happening. So that's what motivated me to conduct this survey that I'm currently doing, to try to obtain at least some hint as to what's happening.
What's the most common sign of mental illness that you're finding among these DACA recipients and young immigrants? Is it depression? Is it anxiety?
Definitely anxiety is the one that is at the top of the hierarchy. I would say the second one is depression. Depression will limit them in their ability to respond, whereas anxiety is keeping them in their hypervigilant state that allows them to continue to fight, you know, allows them to continue to go on and move on with their daily activities despite of the stress. It also increases risk, right, because we know that the physiology of our bodies eventually breaks down if they're not sleeping, if they're not eating right, and they continue to work at the rate that they're used to. If deportation occurs for them or even for their friends, then we can start seeing some symptoms of trauma-related distress, such as nightmares, you know, and flashbacks and over obsessing about these distressing thoughts and things like that.
So do you find that there are cultural barriers to finding help? Because I'm thinking in many Mexican households, many Hispanic households, the idea of searching for psychological help is not really at the top of your priorities. You're sort of brought up to, you deal with it and you move on.
Absolutely. I mean, I think in the case of this population, we're not only seeing a cultural variance or a cultural factor that is there in terms of mental health seeking behavior, but then we're also having the contextual additive effect of fear, right? Fear of deportation, whether a lot of these kids are in colleges or are in high school campuses, that they could obtain help from even the counseling staff that is there at these institutions. Often these services are free, but they don't go because it's a fear of being identified. So definitely, we're talking about two different layers, right? The cultural stigma that is so prevalent in our culture about that, and then on the other side, the fear of deportation. However, I have to say that our strongest ally right now are advocacy organizations and faith-based communities. Because they say they come to us, you know, because they know the confidentiality will be preserved and it's more kind of like culturally acceptable to go and talk to them about this. So rather than looking at it from a disease perspective or from a pathology perspective, I'm trying to emphasize a strength-based approach. So it's like, you know, how to keep you stronger, right? You know, because it's within you. And I think our community is very responsive to that.
So what are you trying to accomplish with this survey you're undertaking? First, give us a little bit of background on the survey and what information you're collecting and what you hope to accomplish.
Definitely, I can see a difference between when I collected data in 2014 and now, because people are very much afraid of talking. Whereas before, you know, people were talking to us or were talking to the media. So people are afraid of retaliation. There is an increase in mistrust that is happening. But we're doing online resources to try to maintain the confidentiality of it. And the survey is not only targeting DACA recipients, but also anyone who knows someone affected by DACA so that we can have a control group to compare how this is affecting other people in their families as well. So some of the ways in which I'm disseminating these talks that I go to the community leaders, I've attended a lot of health fairs and given the link. It's a little bit challenging because it requires access to technology. We know sometimes this is a limitation in our community. Not so much of the dreamers, you know, because they're different. Like I said, they're acculturated and they have access to those resources, but some of their families may not. Another way is that I have teamed up with some educational institutions and universities, particularly Hispanic-serving institutions and the National Latino Psychological Association, and they're helping me to disseminate the link. So we're trying to gather information among college students who are DACA recipients. We're trying to work also with United We Dream to see if they will endorse the survey and disseminate to their channels. But, you know, it's hard because I think a lot of these organizations have been betrayed, And they have trouble trusting the sources, which is totally understandable.
So what are some examples of the questions that you're asking on this survey?
Well, the first one is a lot of clinical mental health assessment to determine if they're clinically significant distress. Distress that would require mental health services. So it's not necessarily distress that, you know, you feel under your daily life, but it's like, to what level does it meet criteria to be clinically significant in need of treatment? Then we also assess in a lot of coping behavior. So what is it that is helping them cope with this situation? I'll give you an example. Is it social support from their family members? Is it religiosity? Is it ways of thinking? So different cognitive strategies that they can use to reframe the situation in which they're living. And finally, we're also assessing behavior in terms of how the current actions are affecting the activities that they engage in their daily lives. Like, are they not spending money as they used to because they're afraid that deportation could happen? Did they stop going to school? You know, are they not seeking services, health services?
So you have, again, compiled this list of top 10 tips for dreamers to help cope with any sort of anxiety that they might be facing? Since we don't really have time to go through all 10 tips, what are some of the most important ones you think you feel needs to be passed on to dreamers?
If I have to say, the number one is to help them learn how to validate their experience and not to put it down or minimize their distress. So that's the number one, you know, to sit down with their feelings, with their emotion, and acknowledge that there is a reason as to why to feel that way. And the second one is for them to learn to identify their symptoms of distress so that they can monitor how their mental health is moving along the lines, you know, rather than trying to suppress them and ignore them. And the other one is talk and look for support social networks, you know, that could make them feel stronger, that could help them validate that experience, that could help them give them the support they need. I think they do have the support of a lot of our Latino community. I always say the undocumented experience not only affects the undocumented immigrant, but affects all of us as a community, right? Because most of us know at least one person that we love who is undocumented. So, you know, I think they're not alone in the fight, and we're here for them. And it's important that they know that.
That's Luz Garcini, a postdoctoral fellow with Rice University's Department of Psychology. And that's it for Fronteras and our stories from the Southwest this week. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org. Alexis Yancey produced the broadcast. Michelle Dubach is our executive producer. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. Thanks for joining us. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.